People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. I was lucky enough recently to see the Tennessee Williams play The Glass Menagerie, which is on here at the Arena at the Artscape, in a production by Fred Abramser and Marcel Mayer. And if you know Tennessee Williams, you'll know that this is one of his famous plays and that it is really quite something to sit through. What is interesting is that for this particular production, music has been especially composed, and it's been composed for solo cello. The cellist Natasha Otero plays music written by Jaco Grissel, a Cape Town-based musician and theatre maker. He's been involved in numerous theatre productions since 2008, and also quite a variety, working as music director, pianist, guitarist, production designer. He regularly performs with the acoustic duo called Mac and Miller. And he produced a production of the Broadway show Rent at the André Huguenet Theatre in Bloemfontein. He's also a teacher and lecturer in systematic music analysis and oral training. We'll get to that in a moment. Jaco, welcome to People of Note.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I would just like to know, having heard and seen the play now and heard that it's quite a concept, how did the concept come up of having a solo cello and you being asked to write the music? Tell me the background.
Yes, well, in the script they do specify that they want music, and Tennessee Williams was quite particular about where he actually wanted music to be played. So I think his conception always included music. If you think about the opening monologue in the show, the character of Tom Wingfield mentions that in memory everything happens to music, and then he refers explicitly to the musician. The choice of cello came from Fred. In the script, they refer to a fiddle, which is probably what Tennessee Williams had in mind originally. Fred felt that the cello had a little bit more of the gravitas, maybe the lower register.
Mm. Also, it adds to the darkness of the play, doesn't it?
Exactly, it does.
Orally.
It does, yes. So that's why Fred decided he wants to go with cello. And I love the instrument, so I was only too happy to oblige and write for it.
And what did you think when you were asked? Did you think, goodness, where do I start? Did you know the play, for example?
I did not. I knew the name, but I had very little idea of what it was about. I'm a little bit uninformed sometimes with the details of drama. I'm much more of a musical theatre person.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
Yeah.
So what did you do? Did you have to study the script?
Yes, that's usually where it starts. I read the script through about four or five times, and each time, the first time typically I just read it to get a general sense of it, and then from the second time I would start to make more notes and write in ideas of where I think there would be music and possible themes, just very free, not editing too much. And then maybe after the third and the fourth reading I actually go to the manuscript paper and start sketching ideas very quickly. I'm not thinking about it too much, just a kind of first reaction.
To get it down, sort of thing, on paper.
Yes, exactly. Just to have a starting point, you know. There's not really a starting point until you actually just get going. That's the most difficult part of composition.
Exactly, like writer's block. This would apply to a composer as well.
Yes, yeah.
So as you were reading, could you sort of, I have a naive question, could you sort of hear the cello in your head, what you wanted it to do?
Yeah, well, I had the idea of that it should probably be in quite a low register, so yeah. You kind of start there and you hum a little bit, and as you're reading you hum away. So okay. And then you go to you write it down and you hear it at the piano, and it's a complex back and forth between.
You know what struck me, Jaco, when I was listening and watching at the opening was, and this is by no means meaning to imply that you were copying anybody, but it reminded me of the atmosphere of the cello suites, the unaccompanied cello suites by Bach, which have a kind of bleakness and yet an intensity and beauty, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Do you agree that there is that sort of feel to some of the pieces?
Well, definitely so. I mean, I did listen to the part of the research process. As I was reading the script, I would also spend a lot of time after reading listening to cello music, solo cello music, just because I'm not a cellist myself. and looking at the score, you get a sense of what cello music looks like and what's the capabilities of the instrument, what can you do and what can you get away with, and these kind of things. So obviously the Bach cello preludes did feature very heavily in that research. And the timbre of the instrument and the kind of textures that you can create, whilst it's very wide in scope, you will always in some way create music that is reminiscent of other music.
Of course, yeah. An influence. It's a compliment to Bach.
Yes,
the greatest compliment.
I think we are in a culture nowadays where people, all, you know, get a very defensive about things like that sometimes when you imply that their music, but that wasn't a problem for somebody like Bach. Even you look at, they copied willy-nilly from one another, and they just took their music out of one piece and put it in another.
That's right. They copied from themselves.
Yeah,
in
it
fact.
It wasn't such an issue because music is functional.
It's quite interesting just hearing you say this. If you're not a cellist, I suppose, did you talk to cellists about, I don't know, what the bow can do, what the fingers can do, the jumps, the bowing?
Unfortunately, because of the time constraints, I didn't have the time to sit down with a cellist and really get it. But the wonder of the modern world is with the internet and YouTube, so I could watch masterclasses given by the best cellists, cello teachers, conductors talking about cello music. You can, there's such a mass of information out there that you can learn from. So I had all the exposure that I wanted, although it is very helpful. I mean, before we finalized the score, I did have a good session with the cellist Natasha, and you know, to go through the music that I've written, and then after that we changed things again when she suggested, like, this might be sound a little bit more like what you actually want, you know.
No,
I mean,
enough.
I think composers really love to think that we always know exactly what we want, but the truth is we generally don't.
Yeah, and it's useful if you have a musician who sort of understands what you're about.
Exactly.
And says, I think I can help you here.
Yeah, and it's just, you can't be too precious about it, because you can learn a lot from these people who've been playing it their whole lives.
I want to find out a little bit more about Natasha in a moment, but Jaco Hrysel, what is your first piece of music to share with us?
Well, a piece by Benjamin Britten, who's probably one of my favorite composers, a British composer, and he wrote 3 divertimenti for string quartet, and this is the second movement, the waltz. It's a lovely little piece, just easy listening. Thank you.
music there by Benjamin Britten, a waltz for string quartet played by the Magini Quartet. And the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, the composer Jaco Kriesel, whose cello work is being performed as part of the Glass Menagerie, the Tennessee Williams play, which is being presented by the Abramser and Mayer production team and is on here at the arena. The cellist in the production is Natasha Otero. And Jaco, how did you discover the cellist? Did Fred Abramser do that? Or tell me a little bit about the lady who's sitting there all on her own playing.
Yes, so Fred was responsible for finding her. I'm actually quite unfamiliar with the whole how he got hold. I think he contacted a friend at UCT and she then recommended Natasha. But Natasha's been doing a great job. She's been fantastic with also helping me know what the cello can do.
So as you said, just giving you some advice, yeah, helping you to get what you want, as
exactly,
you said just now.
Exactly. And she's been great. She's had I feel that she has a real feel for theater, which is rare in musicians, that she knows what the music needs to do. So it was often in the rehearsals we had together more a process of we're just agreeing together at the same time about what the music needs to do and how we need to shape it, which was a lovely experience.
It's interesting, isn't it, how, as you say, she's very much part of the show. It's not background music. She's not sitting backstage. She's right there with a light on her, raised up slightly. So she's integral, isn't she, to the characters on stage, in a sense.
Yeah, I think probably the whole idea is that she's some way the inner monologue of the characters. Even though we get to hear most of their thoughts, she underpins it with the music. And that's also the idea of the music that I wrote, was to try and get some essential aspect of the character and to in some way try to capture that in music, in a musical form.
Because the character you're trying to capture in musical form is actually Tom Wingfield, isn't he? He's sort of the narrator, like almost an alter ego of Tennessee Williams himself.
Yes. So of the four characters, I wrote themes for three of them. Just because the character of the gentleman caller, Jim, at the beginning of the play, they say he's the most realistic character, he's the most outside of that little claustrophobic trio of characters that form the core of the play. So it felt to me that I don't want to give him his own music. So I essentially wrote a theme for Tom, a theme for Amanda, and a theme for Laura. And each of them had very different characters. And it was a wonderful process to try and capture each of their characters in some form in the
because
music.
Isn't it interesting? I mean, we are talking about a fairly remarkable play, Entre the Glass Menagerie.
Yes.
And the characters are so different, yet they're in this very claustrophobic environment. And Fred has set it so that, you know, with the lighting and all that, it's claustrophobic even in a sense for the audience. And because of the arena, you're sitting very close to them, so you pick up their character quite easily.
Yeah.
And so the fact that in the second act, Marcel Mayer, as the gentleman caller, comes in, it's like a breath of fresh air in a sense, and there's no cello. And not that I'm suggesting the cello's a problem.
But if that's the effect that it creates, then it works. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that's what gets communicated, a definite shift in the way the play functions.
I know, as you said earlier, you're a musician, not a theatre person, really, although you've done so much theatre, but we're going to talk about you just now. The number of times you read through this play, and with those monologues, Tennessee Williams has a very special style of writing, doesn't he? I remember talking to Marcel about that. Can be tricky to learn, but once you've got it under your skin, it flows very easily. And it seems to me that you must have picked that up because of the way it flows with a cello accompaniment.
Yeah. It was so after I wrote down the themes and did my initial sketches, Fred and Marcel at that point, they were in America doing their work there. So I was kind of left on my own for a month. And I compiled all those themes, those musical ideas, into a suite of 5 minutes or 6 minutes of music, which was very useful because it also gives me the chance to work with the material as a composer and see what their potential are for development and what one can do with them. So I presented that suite to them, and even though that never appears in the show in that form. So then after that, took each of these themes and kind of, after Fred and I pinpointed where the music goes, we then placed them in, and also I listened to the actors as they read through the script and timed the monologues and things, and then working with that timing, try to fit the music into that. So there must have been some kind of cross influence there.
Yeah, with the rhythm of the text.
Yes.
And
yes.
What was in your head about what you wanted to portray for that particular.
Yes.
I was just thinking, you mentioned the word sweet just now.
Yes.
Is there any chance, when this is finished now, this play is finished, is there any chance that you'll release this on a commercial CD? Or would we ever hear it again? Or is it going to vanish into one of your bottom drawers?
No, it will probably vanish into the bottom drawer.
Oh, no.
Well, I love writing music like this because of the functionality of it. And to be honest, there's not a lot of opportunity to write music like this, unfortunately, even though I do love it. It definitely helps the writing to not think that you're creating something for the ages here, that you're just writing something that you're going to use for this run, and maybe... If this has a life beyond this production or this run, the Glass Menagerie goes on tour or comes back, then I would revisit it and write. But to keep the functionality of the music first and foremost, and that's why I've always preferred to write music for plays, for or musicals, because of the it forms one part of the whole. It's part of creating an effect.
Yeah. And interesting as well, when you say, you talk about functionality and all that, it's got this, you know, sometimes people are fearful, I'm sure you know this, of so-called 21st century music, but the music is certainly accessible, hence me mentioning right at the beginning the kind of, it reminded me of the Bach cello suites.
Yes.
That sense of wanting you to listen. In fact, it's a bit of a challenge, Jaco, I must tell you, when you're in the theatre, because you need to concentrate on those dialogues that Tennessee Williams writes. And then the cello is also very interesting, and you you're using all your sensibilities, actually.
Yes. I generally prefer to write more accessible music, and not as a goal in itself. But I do think that I interact with the text, or really try to keep to the text. It brings out something a little less intellectual. Not that the music's unintellectual, but let's say this 21st century music and recent music, because they are written by composers often with a very strong sense of history and feeling like they have to add on to the great works of the past, and they have to keep exploring the furthest reaches of what we can write, the music does tend to become overly intellectual without any real link to how people perceive music and enjoy music.
Mm-hmm.
So if you jettison that idea of that you have to write music that's intellectually stimulating as a goal in itself, and then you also have this framework within which you write, which is very much a framework of human emotions and the characters and how they interact with one another, you do end up with more human music.
That's beautifully put, and thank you for saying that. Now, your next piece of music, Jaco.
Well, so this is leading on from our conversation. I've always been a massive fan of Maurice Ravel. I've probably always been attracted to his music because he was known as such a craftsman of writing music, almost playing a game of seeing what he can do and how he can manipulate the music to create effect, not going all out that the music is an expression of himself in some kind of way. So this is a lovely little piano piece, and pardon my pronunciation, is the Minuet sur le nom d'Aiden, which is a little piece that he wrote. I think it was some celebration of Haydn's life that happened, and a French publisher put out these commissions for composers to write music on a little theme that was that they derived from Haydn's name. I think it was five notes or so. And it's played by Vlado Perlmutter, the famous interpreter of Ravel.
Thank you.
music by Ravel there, piano music by Ravel. And to punish you, I'm going to ask you to say your French again, Jacques. What was that?
Minuet sur le nom d'Aiden.
And the pianist Vladimir Perlmutter. Yeah. My guest is Jacques Grissel, who wrote the music for The Glass Menagerie, the play by Tennessee Williams, which is on at the Arena here at Artscape, I think till about the end of the month. And I thoroughly recommend you go and see it. It's an extraordinary afternoon or evening in the theatre with solo cello as part of the whole production, music written by Jacques. While it was playing, listening to the piano music there, we were discussing, weren't we, Jacques, about Ravel being a miniaturist.
Yes.
But being a miniaturist, he loved orchestration, but he wrote for a huge orchestra. He really scored for a vast orchestra.
As we were chatting, there's a contradiction in him, in the man, or it seems to be that his natural composer instinct was for small detailed works with very, very fine details and well crafted. But then if you read his biographies and so on, you see that he's always almost had a greater interest in orchestration. That's why he's given us these wonderful orchestrations, like the Mussorgsky Pictures at an Exhibition.
Yes, famously.
And obviously Bolero, which is almost a study in orchestration and in orchestral colors and how you can combine them. So there's something interesting in the man there, that he seems to have shied away, I guess, from freewheeling creativity and like to latch onto something which gave him some certainty and sense of, because orchestration is very much a craft. There is some creativity involved, but it's a wonderful thing to do because the music's already written and you just play with it in some ways.
I mean, he was a great teacher as well. Famously, he taught Ray Vaughan Williams.
Yeah.
And when Vaughan Williams went back to England, suddenly we heard this extraordinary change in his orchestration. But the other interesting thing is Ravel wrote so much for the piano, which he then orchestrated, which is probably what you're saying, isn't underlining what you're saying, that he took his own pieces and orchestrated them, like Le Tombeau de Couperin.
Yes. And it's. I think that's probably an extension of that impulse of wanting to orchestrate your own works. It's an interesting challenge. Mm-hmm. And from what we can gather from Ravel's life, he seems to always have enjoyed the idea of games, playing games and challenges and setting parameters for himself, which is always a big problem for composers, setting parameters, like especially nowadays where, not nowadays so much anymore, but let's say that period, let's say at the end of the 19th century to, let's say, the end of the 20th century, where composition became completely freewheeling, all the rules were jettisoned, and there's almost no, like Stravinsky always talked about, the frightening freedom.
Like
you think you want that until you get it, and to not have parameters is awful. Like I know personally, again coming back to what I said earlier, that's why I love to write for theatre, because the parameters are there. When you're writing without parameters, you are just confronted with your own lack of originality and ideas because you keep writing the same piece again and again and again.
But talking about that, Jacques, I just want to find out a bit more about you and all these things you do and why we're talking about orchestration. Are there times where you've had to, do you write for orchestra?
I don't compose for orchestra, or I haven't had the opportunity. I would love to, and I have when I was studying. But as a professional, I haven't had the chance yet. I have orchestrated a lot, though. I have arranged music for the Stellenbosch City Orchestra and the Bloemfontein Philharmonic. And every now and again, at least three or four times a year, I get good big commissions from these orchestral ensembles.
And you enjoy that, even though it's not your work. But still, you've got to create this tapestry of sound, don't you?
Yeah, I love it. I love arranging, always loved arranging and orchestrating music.
So tell me a little bit about your background. You're a young man. When did the music bug bite?
My music story is definitely not the normal one. I can't claim to be some kind of child prodigy or anything. I had a very cultural family, but they'd never forced us into any kind of direction. I played double bass when I was younger for a couple of years, and then eventually started playing classical guitar. From there, it kind of went off the rails when I went into the rock scene for a couple of years and played rock electric guitar. And after school, didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do. So for some reason, I ended up in theater and studied a course in theater making. and worked as a freelance theater technician for 2 years after that. And during that time, I've always kept up my music as a guitarist. And sometime during that time, the bug for writing really bit, and I mostly self-taught up till that point. And then I luckily got in at the University of the Free State, and from there it just took off. Absolutely loved it.
Because you have done a lot of things. I said at the beginning, music director, pianist, guitarist, yeah. production designer. And you also have a little group, don't you, Mac and Miller?
Yes.
That's your. I presume that's where you can relax and enjoy performing your own pieces with your partner.
Well, it's mostly arrangements. It's just a little side gig we do at markets and things like that. That's always fun to take songs that people know and more older, typically like from the 80s and the 70s and songs like that, and we rearrange them for mm-hmm. acoustic guitar and a hand percussion and things like that too. It's another interesting experiment in arranging, to take something from the 80s, rock music from the 80s,
which everyone knows well,
and it's quite a saturated sound with lots of keyboard and saxophone and guitars and bass and everything going, and then to just reduce it to two instruments and two voices is quite it's enjoyable little experiment.
So what does it consist of, Mac and Miller?
It's just me and my partner Zoe McLaughlin, and we sing. And
do you sing as well? So you sing and you both play instruments?
Yes. Zoe plays hand percussion, I play guitar, and we both sing together. She sings the lead. I'm not that much of a singer.
Okay, and have you written anything for Mac and Miller?
No.
It's
all covers, yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah,
so. All right, well, let's have another piece of music. What is your next fascinating, riveting choice? And I'm not sending you up.
Well,
I'm not sure what's going to come next.
Well, this is quite an unknown one. It's an American composer called Lucas Foss, and he wrote a capriccio for cello and piano. Now, I didn't know this piece before I was commissioned with this work, and this was one of the works that I listened to as research for my work for the Glass Menagerie. It's in style and in aesthetic, it's very different to the music I ended up writing, but I just loved the music a lot. I'm probably going to never stop listening to it now that it's kind of entered my attention. Thank you.
music there by Lucas Foss. What was that, a capriccio you heard?
Yes, capriccio for cello and piano.
And as you said, something that you find very inspiring, helped you with music for the Glass Menagerie.
Yes, yes.
Jaco Chrysler is my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, and he is the composer of the cello music played by Natasha Otero in the production of the Glass Menagerie, which is on here at the Artscape Arena. And it gives an extra reason for you to go along and see it, to listen to this remarkable cello music, Jaco. But one of the other things I wanted to ask you, again at the beginning I said you're a teacher and lecturer, and you have this very fancy subject, systematic music analysis and oral training. You lectured at the Free State University for a while. What does that mean, actually?
It's music theory.
Is it?
No, it's that's what I lectured at the University of the Free State in, and it has kind of followed me now into my current teaching. So it's perspectives of looking, looking at music, and the relationship with theory and music is always a complicated one, especially as a composer. You don't know where the one ends and the other starts. It's not just inspiration, as any composer will tell you. It's a romanticized idea of it, that you just sit down and the music just flows from you. Sometimes something like that happens, but it's not part of the job. Mm-hmm. So I studied music theory quite extensively. I've always found it fascinating, and various perspectives of looking at pieces of music and what that then illuminates. But the piece of music as it stands there is very much something on its own that has its own rules, and even the composer, they very seldomly are completely in control of what it is. Sometimes when the composer has the most idea of what they wrote, it's probably not that great.
Really?
Because it's too conscious. Not that consciousness is a bad thing, but it's defined too much. And I think that's in all forms of art nowadays. We're struggling with definition. People are defining their artworks too much. It's got to be about something very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of, sometimes it doesn't help. Unless, of course, it's like this music for the Glass Menagerie, where it forms part of something bigger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. But now, to get back to your question, I currently lecture at LAMTA, the Leighton Alexander Musical Theatre Academy.
That's at the Peter Turin Theatre, isn't it?
Yes,
that new school that they've built up there.
Yes, yes, wonderful.
In the roof.
Yes, yeah, no, wonderful, wonderful teaching institution. And it's I teach sight singing there, which is a kind of a practical extension of applied theory, and then ear training, training the ears.
Which you call basic music literacy.
Yes, yes.
Like your titles of these things.
Yeah.
Which is so important, isn't it? That these things are important to round an actor, which I know Anton and Dwayne are trying to do at that complex. So it makes them a rounded performer, giving them the musical side as well.
Definitely, definitely. It's a wonderful skill, and I think it's about time in South Africa that we start to make that the norm rather than the exception. Mm-hmm. That musical theatre actors and actresses have that ability to interact with the score other than just listening to the cast recording and copying, because the people that they try to emulate, they've gone through the process of working with what the composer wrote down and then adding their interpretation on top. Whereas if you don't have the capabilities to work with the score, all you're doing is you're looking at the emulation and emulating that again. So it doesn't really grow from there.
And that happens in classical music as well, doesn't it? Because although the score is there very clearly and distinctly what you should be doing, a lot of people copy one interpretation and don't think about it enough.
That's probably true. Yeah, it's good to go to the score and then listen to your. You do learn through imitation as well, but having at least two or three sources is always a better option than just going to copying. So you can listen to good interpretations or acknowledge the interpretations, one or two of them, and you can look at the score. And in between that, it's kind of the things that catch your ear that you like, that's all going to come together then in your version of it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you, Jaco, do you get a chance to listen to much music? I know classical music is important too. We've spoken about Bach influencing you. You spoke about Benjamin Britten influencing you so hugely. And you said you did your master's thesis on Ravel, didn't you?
Yes,
dissertation.
Yes.
And do you do much listening for relaxation, possibly, not for research?
No, I actually do for relaxation. I do. It's very wide what I listen to. It varies quite a lot, and I go through phases of what I listen to. I don't get out that much because, you know, as a performer myself and somebody very, you know, active in the industry, I do have enough time, but I just have it at the wrong times. So I can't go out and support the fellow performers because I'm usually busy myself in the evenings. So, when I do listen to music, it's in the mornings and enjoy a wide variety of things.
I liked your joke at the beginning before we came into the studio where you said you'd love to go and see the Cape Town Philharmonic more often, but if they played in the morning,
you'd be able to go. Yeah. I've been very, very bad with attending these concerts just because, yeah.
Anyway, let's have another piece of music.
All right. This is something a little bit different. It's a tango suite by Piazzolla, the first movement called the Sisso, the designation of it, and it's played by Sergio and Oder Assad, Egyptian brothers, so it's for guitar duo, classical guitar duo, and Piazzolla originally wrote this for the two brothers to play, and it's a wonderful, obviously with a Latin American, South American flavor and a lot of percussive playing on the guitar, wonderful piece. Thank you.
Music by Piazzolla with two guitars there, the Egyptian brothers Sergio and
Oder
Assad.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, another choice of my guest, Jaco Grissel, the musician, the Cape Town-based musician and theatre maker, and who's written the music for The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams, the Abrams and Mayer production. And by the way, it's got quite a cast. Fiona Ramsey, Jenny Stead, Matthew Baldwin, and Marcel Mayer, directed by Fred Abrams. And the cellist is Natasha Otero. It is, I have to tell you, a fairly riveting 2 hours in the theatre, not only because of the acting, but because of your music, Jaco.
Thank you, thank you.
Which I still feel one day I would like to hear on its own. But may I ask you, what now? This has been a long time. What are you going to do next? Do you have projects that you can share with us, or is it all secret?
No. There's some exciting things on its way. I'm going into Rocky Horror rehearsals on Thursday. I'm their rehearsal pianist for their rehearsal period here in Cape Town, which is very exciting. And then there's some other projects with the Peter Turin Productions that I'm going to be involved with in the next couple of years as in various capacities. And then I've also got my own theater production company, Tally Ho Productions, which I started this year. And we are opening our first show in the Baxter Theater next year in March.
Okay, called?
The Last 5 Years. It's a musical, quite a famous musical.
Okay. So that's something to watch out for. We'll talk to you about that, I dare say, Jaco. Interesting, you speak about Rocky Horror Show. Are you enjoying working on that? Because one thinks of that as such a cult piece that you sort of want it always to sound like the film, and of course it mustn't sound like the film.
Yeah. Well, as a rehearsal pianist, my job is very defined, luckily. I just have to make sure that I can play that music as well as I possibly can. And it's fun music to play, the kind of rock and roll 50s, 60s style of piano playing. It's exhausting to play because you're always busy, but I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying working. I have enjoyed preparing it.
Well, Jaco, it's been great talking to you, and congratulations on your achievement for the show, The Glass Menagerie. It really is an integral part of the enjoyment of the experience in the theatre. And come back and talk to us again. But what is your last piece? What are you going to walk out the studio with?
So seeing as we ended off with musical theatre here, we're going to go with a song from the musical The Light in the Piazza. It's the title number called The Light in the Piazza. And the musical's by Adam Gettle, who is the grandson of Richard Rodgers.
Oh, really?
So the family has some stakes there in the musical theatre world.
Jaco, it's been great talking to you, and all the best. And as I say, come and see us again. Jaco Grissel.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And then it fills the air.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Be crazy about you, baby.
Forever Plaid, the heavenly 1950s musical comedy, is now on stage. Come experience the best music of the 1950s, including Catch a Falling Star, Three Coins in the Fountain, Love is a Many Splendored Thing, and many more, crooned beautifully by a quartet of handsome lads. Don't miss Forever Plaid at Peter Turin's Theater on the Bay from the 6th to the 23rd November. Book now through CompuTicket.